This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Crops have failed, livestock has perished, and children are lucky to receive one meal per day. The situation is dire, and the need for action has never been clearer.
That's Thompson Piri, the World Food Program spokesperson for Southern Africa, on how drought already has hit the region hard, with the annual lean season just starting. Details coming up. Also, Kenya's High Court is allowing the Senate to debate an impeachment motion against the deputy president. And Nigeria is working to restore power after the power grid collapsed last night. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United Nations reports around 733 million people, or 1 in 11 people, are going hungry because of conflicts, climate change, and economic downturn. Among this number are more than 6 million people across the Lake Chad region, the highest number in the past 4 years. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations reports around 733 million people, or 1 in 11 people, are going hungry because of conflicts, climate change, and economic downturn. Among this number are more than 6 million people across the Lake Chad region, the highest number in the past 4 years. Yan Bonzon is head of delegation for Nigeria for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He says rampant insecurity due to conflict is preventing farmers from planting their crops, and climate shocks, he says, have damaged crops, contributing to a food crisis in Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. Speaking on a video link from Nigeria, he says the consequences of armed conflict in the Lake Chad region, compounded by climate change, continue killing people, especially young children, who are the most vulnerable.
Every day, doctors and nurses in health facilities we support in northeast Nigeria receive and treat severely malnourished kids. Desperate mothers tell us every day how healthy children become weak and fall sick, and how putting food on the table has turned into a daily struggle.
Bonzon says the number of children treated for severe malnutrition in ICRC health facilities in northeast Nigeria has increased by 24% over the past year. A similarly distressing scenario is playing out in southern Africa. The United Nations warns a widespread drought in the region triggered by an El Nino weather pattern could turn into a full-scale humanitarian catastrophe without international assistance. The World Food Program says this historic drought has devastated more than 27 million lives across the region. WFP spokesperson for Southern Africa, Thompson Fury, says some 21 million children are malnourished. He adds many communities regard this as the worst food crisis in decades.
October in Southern Africa marks the start of the lean season, and each month is expected to be worse than the previous one until harvest next year in March and April. Crops have failed, livestock has perished, and children are lucky to receive one meal per day. The situation is dire, and the need for action has never been clearer.
WFP says a record 5 countries, Lesotho, Malawi, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, have declared the hunger crisis a state of disaster and are calling for international support. The agency notes Angola and Mozambique also are severely affected. The UN's food agency says international humanitarian support is desperately needed. Unfortunately, it says it has received only one-fifth of the $369 million needed to provide life-saving assistance to millions in southern Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Since April 2023, a war has been raging in Sudan between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy paramilitary Rapid Support Forces Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The UN reports that more than 10 million people, about a fifth of Sudan's population, have been forced from their homes due to the conflict. Among them is Sudanese journalist Shakur Naiketo, who fled to Qatar via Ethiopia and Kenya. VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke to Naiketo about the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
We left the country, we went through different countries. From Sudan, we crossed the border to Ethiopia. From Ethiopia, we went to Kenya. And after maybe 8 months or even more than that, then we made it finally to Qatar. And we are still looking for actually place, to settle. Two warring parties are insisting to fight because the Sudanese armed forces decided to end this war militarily, and also the rapid support forces decided to continue on fighting. So this is the reason that why the war age is prolonged. And there were so many different initiatives in Saudi Arabia, and the last one is in Geneva, but they were not able to actually come together. And that's why they are still continuous in their fighting. And the more they fight, the more civilians get affected by it. And also because the army has its own reasons why they don't want to stop the war. They're asking the RSF to actually leave the cities, and they ask them to leave their military bases, and then they have to leave their military artilleries outside the cities and the places where they are, and the RSF is actually rejecting that, and that's why there is a back and forth, fighting.
I'm sure you still have some relatives left in Sudan. When you talk to them, what's the situation like on the ground? How are they able to even to provide for their families when this war is going on?
Very tough humanitarian situation right now. We talk to our families, we talk to people in Sudan. Most of the people are actually facing very big, issues family. Right now, especially living, life expenses every day. And there is no food. People are facing hunger. More than 20 million people are actually hurting by hunger and famine because of the war. Either you have a family member outside the country, like in the border somewhere, they send them money, or they expect the charitable organizations or charitable groups, they are inside there, and then they are providing food for the people, but nobody is able actually to provide for themselves.
Who has more of an advantage? Is it the government forces or RSF?
Every Sudanese would want to see the National Army. That's, I think, naturally everybody will be in support of the National Army. RSF was part of the army and then rebelled against the army. And now people are supporting the army. At the same time, there are people who are supporting the RSF. So even the people right now are divided. And the war right now moved from the war between the rapid support forces and the Sudanese armed forces into civil war right now between even communities, because the rapid support process is backed by tribes and backed by ethnicities, and that's why the army also is backed by other people. Now the fighting is actually moving not only within the military, but the war has exceeded that into the community.
That was VOA's Paul Ndiho speaking with Shakur Naiketo, a Sudanese journalist now based in Qatar. Kenya's High Court today rejected a request by the deputy president's lawyers to stop the Senate from debating an impeachment motion against him after Parliament voted to remove him from office last week. Justice Chacha Mwati ruled that Parliament will be allowed to proceed with its constitutional mandate. The Associated Press quoted him as saying the court will not interfere. Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua, his impeachment motion was approved by a 281-44 vote in Parliament last week and forwarded to the Senate, which will begin hearings on Wednesday. If a two-thirds majority approves the motion, it would be the first time that a sitting deputy president is impeached in Kenya. Gachagua is facing impeachment over corruption and other irregularities, including allegations that he supported anti-government protests in June. He denies all the charges against him. The debate surrounding his fate has extended beyond parliament. Supporters and opponents of the motion clashed last week in public after the ruling alliance brought it before parliament. President William Ruto has yet to publicly comment, but is on record in the earlier days of his presidency saying that he will not publicly humiliate his deputy, alluding to the troubled relationship he had with his predecessor, Uhuru Kenyatta, during their second term in office. The Transmission Company of Nigeria says it's working to restore power after blackouts engulfed the country following another collapse of the power grid on Monday night. Reuters reports that power generation fell to zero. By Tuesday morning, some plants in the capital Abuja and parts of the commercial city were coming online. Daily average supply has hovered around 4,500 megawatts in recent times until the sixth collapse this year. Nigeria's grid has shut down due to aging power infrastructure, vandalism, and inadequate gas supply for its thermal plants, which account for over 75% of output. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and find us on voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. That number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. The United Nations says today it is troubled by the presidential election campaign in Tunisia, saying it was marred by a crackdown on the opposition. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk says their trials indicate a lack of respect for due process and fair trial guarantees. 3 years after making a sweeping power grab, Kais Saied was selected president with a 90.69% of the votes cast, Tunisia's electoral authority announced yesterday. According to the French news agency AFP, Turk recalled that out of 17 prospective candidates, only 3 were accepted. More than 100 prospective candidates, their campaign members, and other political figures were arrested on a variety of charges ranging from falsification of electoral paperwork to issues related to national security. In the last month of U.S. presidential campaigning, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are both trying to reach the relatively small number of voters who say they have still not decided who to support. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at the undecideds in this election.
Some Americans are already making their choice for president, with early voting underway in many states. But there remain voters who say they are undecided between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. New York voter Mary Beth Giovaccini.
You know, I just want to see, like, I want to understand who they are. They haven't really been involved much, and they're new to the entire political climate on both sides. They come from both interesting different backgrounds, and I want to see who they are and how they represent their candidates.
Undecided voters are about 3% of the electorate, according to public opinion polls. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University's law school.
For a lot of voters, they haven't started paying that much attention yet. And so I think when you come up and ask them, that's the answer they might give. Some people also in the Midwest might be reticent to tell you who they'll vote for. So there could be some of that as well.
Targeted campaigning by Harris and Trump is moving some undecided voters, says University of Massachusetts political scientist Tatiche Nteta.
The population of the undecided voter is shrinking, and it shrinks with each day. Most people are going to make up their minds before Election Day, and what's really going to matter is going to be the on-the-ground mobilization of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and in what is likely going to be an extremely close election.
Trump and Harris have different challenges in convincing undecided voters, says Brookings Institution senior fellow Darrell West.
He needs to reassure Americans that, one, he respects the rule of law, that he's not going to be crazy and chaotic if he becomes a president. She, on the other hand, is less experienced. She took positions a few years ago that were much more liberal than the policies that she's espousing now. So she has to reassure voters that it's the Kamala Harris of today that they're going to get as president.
Trump, as the better known of the candidates, has both advantages and disadvantages when it comes to undecided voters, says Johnson.
Donald Trump is a candidate running for the third time for president, so most people have strong opinions about him already. And so of that sliver of people who remain undecided, just a single-digit percentage number of people, both parties are working hard to convince them to vote.
That's because those undecided voters could make the difference in close swing state races that will likely decide who wins. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
South Africa is planning a massive mouse eradication project on a sub-Antarctic island to stop the invasive species from wiping out the precious seabirds that nest there. Kate Bartlett spoke to some of the experts involved.
Marion Island in the southern Indian Ocean, almost 2,000 kilometers from Cape Town, is a remote and windswept South African territory that's home to extensive bird life, including the wandering albatross. But those birds face an unusual threat, predatory mice that have been feasting on their chicks. The mice are an accident of history, but their population has been increased by climate change.
The mice were introduced accidentally in the early 1800s, so some 200 years ago now. They came ashore, they were essentially stowaways on the vessels of the early seal hunters that visited the island.
That was Anton Wolfart, a conservationist who's leading the program to eradicate the mice. As the island has grown warmer and drier due to climate change, it has also grown more favorable for the mice. And now, by the end of the summer, the mouse population increases by 500%, he explained. It was only fairly recently that researchers on Marion first observed the mice preying on chicks, but the phenomenon has increased.
So we have a situation now that the mice are such a threat that experts predict that 19 of the 29 bird species on Marion Island face local extinction in the presence of mice.
Elsa van Ginkel is a researcher who was employed by the University of Pretoria to collect data on the island last year.
And these islands are truly out of this world. Walking amongst wandering albatross chicks every day and watching them grow into fledglings. Wow. Just wow. It's an absolute privilege.
But they are slowly being wiped out.
These fledglings have no means of defending themselves from a mouse that actually starts eating it alive. It's quite horrific.
So BirdLife South Africa, a non-governmental organization, and South Africa's Forestry, Fisheries and Environment Department are planning a major intervention to save the seabirds and restore the island to its natural state. Wolfart is heading the initiative, which is still seeking funding and is scheduled to take place in a few years.
Very simply, the operation involves broadcasting a specialized rodenticide bait from bait spreader buckets that are slung beneath helicopters that are guided by GPS technology.
The pellets of rodent poison won't negatively affect the rest of the flora and fauna on the island, experts say. A similar project has been undertaken before. In the 1940s, feral cats were introduced to Marion Island to try and control the mice, but then the felines started preying on the seabirds. The cats were successfully eradicated in the early 1990s, although that, of course, left the mice to flourish. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
An international conference in Australia of First Nations people is calling on scientists to engage with Indigenous experts to find solutions to climate change. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Indigenous Australians consider the land to be the mother of creation. To them, it's a living, breathing mass that contains secrets and wisdom. Tribal leaders have gathered in Dubbo, 390 kilometres northwest of Sydney, to urge governments and scientists to do more to harness the knowledge of First Nations peoples to combat climate change. Glenn Wingfield is from the Kakatha Aboriginal Corporation in South Australia. In an official video, he said the conference is part of a growing movement.
We get on top of this, try and slow this global warming and all that stuff, and get the message out to young people. We need more and more voices. There's one or two people, you go knock at the door, they tell you to go away. If you're going to come with a big mob, you know, they're going to start listening.
Indigenous communities around the world have relied on a deep understanding of their environments to survive. Kyle White is a professor of environmental justice at the University of Michigan. He's attending the summit in Dubbo, Australia, as a science envoy for the US State Department. He has said previously that First Nations people around the world have already been through an environmental apocalypse because of the theft of customary lands. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Tuesday that the impact of dispossession continues to this day.
Going back several centuries, it was Indigenous people's lands that were first sacrificed to make way for mining and other industries that we now know are responsible for human-caused climate change.
The Canadian government has set up a partnership with Indigenous peoples to help tackle climate change. In 2023, the Ottawa government said that First Nations, Inuit and Métis in Canada are at the forefront of efforts to adapt to the impacts of our changing climate. In New Zealand, authorities have acknowledged that for many Indigenous Māori, climate change is not an isolated risk, but is intrinsically linked to other issues, such as social development needs, housing, environmental degradation and poverty. Indigenous elders have said that First Nations people of Australia, who make up about 3% of the national population, contribute the least to climate change, yet the impacts of climate change are affecting us most severely. The Climate Summit in Dubbo runs October 14 to 18 and is jointly run by the local Tubbaga Wiradjuri Aboriginal Corporation. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.